At Emory University, we believe in those with the ambition to achieve, the passion to learn, and the optimism to see the possibilities ahead. Founded on a belief that the wise heart seeks knowledge, an Emory education combines experiential learning in Atlanta and beyond with unrivaled collaboration and discovery, all to prepare you for a world that needs your leadership. Learn more at emory.edu.
Welcome to the Mona Charon Show. So glad you could join us today. I'm delighted to welcome Sadanand Dume, who is a fellow at the American Enterprise Institute, Wall Street Journal columnist, and a specialist on Asia. This is a topic that hasn't gotten much attention lately, and so I'm hoping we can get some enlightenment on what is happening in that critical part of the world. But I'd like to begin with Sadanand's own personal story. So can you tell us where you were born, what your influences were growing up?
I was born in New Delhi, India. And I moved around a little bit when I was young because my father was an Indian diplomat. So I was in Washington, D.C. for 3 years. I was in kindergarten here. Then I went back to India. I spent some time in Indonesia, but most of my early life was in India. And then I came to the U.S. in the mid 1990s to go to grad school. I went to Columbia Journalism School. After that, I went to Princeton and I studied public policy there at what used to be called the Woodrow Wilson School. And then I went back to Asia, worked as a foreign correspondent for a few years, wrote a book about the rise of radical Islam in Indonesia, and then found my way back. And I've been back in the U.S. since 2003, and I've been in Washington since 2008.
Excellent. Thank you. One of the things you've written about over the course of many years that I took note of was you did a piece, I think it was in 2015, about why Indian immigrants do so well in the United States and what that says about their country of origin. So I don't know if you remember this piece, but you've written so many, of course. But you quoted, for example, the Pew Research Center that said the median income, again, this is 10 years ago, but the median income for Indian American families in 2010 was $88,000, nearly twice the national average. 70% of Indian Americans had a bachelor's degree or higher compared to the national average of about 30%. What do you think that says about India that so many Indians who come to this country do so spectacularly well? So Silicon Valley is basically a colony.
Also, I wrote that piece because the Indian media, which I follow very closely because of my job, it tends to sort of have this very one-sided view of the phenomenon of Indian American success, and they attribute it almost entirely to how wonderful these people from India are, and how hardworking they are, and how smart they are, and how they have intact families, and all the rest. And I'm not taking away from any of that, but to me, the magic ingredient in this really is America. It's that people come to this country and they're given a fair shake, and their hard work and smarts is rewarded. So I want to I wanted to push back on what was the dominant narrative in India, which seemed to give all the credit to the immigrant group. Whereas I think in reality, it's a combination. I'm not taking anything away from people who've succeeded, people we've heard of, people like, Sundar Pichai or Satya Nadella or any of these tech people. Obviously, they're smart, hardworking, driven people, but they are smart, hardworking, driven people in a country that has traditionally believed in merit, that has believed in giving people a fair shot. And so I think the success of the Indian Americans is as much, if not more, a tribute to America as it is to their effort. And that was really the bulk of my argument.
What would hold back somebody from succeeding in India?
Well, first of all, the other thing is that what you've seen in the US really in many ways is the cream of the crop. So you have like, you know, it's a very, very small percentage. And this is not just true of India, but this is true of many countries. It's a very small percentage of the most driven, most ambitious people who tend to be self-starters, who that's one part of it. The second is that there are various things that hold the same people back in India. So for example, you have very extensive quota systems in government. That in government and in higher education, right? So it makes like, you know, it makes what we've been dealing with in this country with, you know, DEI look like child's play in comparison. So on the one hand, you have
Can you spell that out a little bit? What's the nature of this?
Basically, what you have in India are caste-based quotas in government higher education, which is the best schools, and also in government jobs. And
it's based on caste? Is it based on race? It's based on caste?
It's based on caste. So what that means is that currently, for instance, that out of every 10 jobs in the federal government, only 4 would be filled through an open competition. 6 out of 10 would basically be filled by some kind of quota or the other. So that's one thing. That's kind of, you know, that's one issue. But I think the bigger issue, in fact, has been that, you know, since independence, Indian politics has been marked mostly by socialism of one form or the other. And what that obviously did was that it suppressed the growth of the economy, particularly between 1947 and 1991. There simply weren't enough jobs. People couldn't make a living. That was one part of it. And even now, I think, you know, India struggles to create as many jobs as it needs to. And I would argue that it hasn't really fostered a culture of excellence domestically. This is not to say that there aren't many excellent people who have thrived, but I think that in general, the dominant culture fostered by Indian politics is not a culture of meritocracy. And that just means that many of the people who have done very well over here, they may have done reasonably in India also. But another example I tend to give is that if let's just say you're a smart 21-year-old and you get out of school in India, you do have options. But if you wanted to go and if you're oriented towards public service and you wanted to work for the government, for example, you would hit the quota system. Probably, right? But if you go to the private sector, you would be okay in some private companies, but a lot of private companies in India are dominated by families. And so there you sort of, you know, so you have where on the private side of the ledger, your growth would probably be capped because the company is going to be headed, you know, by the not very bright son of the owner rather than by you. So I think that's sort of, you know, those are some of the reasons that people tend to do, people often tend to do better in capitalist countries, particularly in the Anglosphere, not just in the US, in the UK and Canada and so on.
So what would you say to the argument that one would commonly hear in many Ivy League universities, for example, that the reason that India is poor and the reason that India has less opportunity than the United States or many other places is because it suffered under centuries of colonialism, and that kind of extractive colonialism that the British practiced left India unable to provide opportunity for its people.
So a couple of things. I mean, the first is I think that would have been a much stronger argument had we been having this conversation in 1950 rather than in 2025. The second is that I don't want to pretend that colonialism was ever a particularly good experience. But if you had to pick a colonial power, you probably wanted to pick the Brits. You certainly did not want to pick the Belgians.
No.
You did not want to pick the Portuguese. And so I'd say, you know, the colonial experience was a mixed bag. Obviously, if you look at the, you know, Indian growth rates in the last 50 years before independence, they were very low. They were, you know, somewhere around 1%. So it's not as though, but I personally sort of don't like the idea of attributing everything to colonialism, particularly because, you know, the Brits left a long time ago. And the state that India was in, say, 1965, when the first wave of migrants started leaving India for American shores, or even the state it's in today, is largely due to the policies that were followed by India's own leaders post-independence.
So more recently, you've written about Mamdani, this new hot candidate for mayor of New York. It was, you wrote two pieces about him that I thought were just fantastic. So if you don't mind, I would like to spend a little time on this, because your experience reporting on Asia and India and so forth is relevant here too. I think you bring interesting perspective. So he is being perceived as the, you know, so the Democrats, as we know, the Democrats are in agony right now as a party. They cannot believe that they've been defeated by Trump twice. And they are aware of their shortcomings with the voters, that they're losing the working class and so on. And so they are looking for something fresh, new, exciting to offer voters. And a lot of people are excited about Mamdani. And what you said is, there's nothing fresh and new about his ideas. So let's talk about that. This is a democratic socialist who is, for example, in favor of rent control. So why don't you give us a
example of your argument? I'm particularly interested in him because he's of Indian background,
right?
Via Uganda, but both of his parents are ethnic Indians. His mother grew up in India. His father, of course, grew up in Uganda. And I know people who knew his mother when she was in college.
So, oh, really?
Yeah. And I've watched all her movies and so on. So a couple of things. First of all, I think we have to acknowledge that it's understandable why people are enthusiastic about him is not inexplicable. He makes mm-hmm. really good social media videos. He's good on camera. He has a great smile. He has an infectious grin. He is clever and cheeky. I don't know if you saw that ad he'd made about going to Uganda, and he had these sort of fake New York Post headlines. So I understand that. But I do think that if you sort of examine his ideas, and there are two sets of ideas that I'm particularly concerned about. One, of course, is his economic ideas. And I wrote one column that was focused mostly on that. And
Let's start there.
Yeah. So in his economic ideas, I mean, I thought it was kind of ironic because it was almost as though here's a person who is 33 years old, has never experienced socialism, but he comes from a family background where they very much have experience socialism. So a little factoid that your listeners may not be aware of, but his maternal grandfather helped set up one of the iconic steel plants that was set up early after Indian independence in the Nehru era, which is really, and those steel plants were really the biggest symbols of Nehruvian socialism and state-led planning. And his grandfather himself was, in fact, directly responsible for setting up one of those. So that's a little factoid where his own family history intersects with India's failed experiment with socialism. Mm-hmm. I grew up in India. So, you know, if you ask me about my influences and, you know, why, you know, some people would argue I'm such a rabid capitalist, it's because I've seen socialism up close, Mona. I've lived it, and I don't have any romantic ideas about it. I have absolutely no doubt that that a government-run grocery store is going to be a disaster. Mm-hmm. I don't believe in rent control because of what it does to the market and so on. But I think that what is interesting is that he belongs to this generation, and perhaps, you know, in a sense, maybe his. The fact that he comes from a family that would have experienced this directly or would even have implemented some of this is just a coincidence, right? Because there are plenty of democratic socialists in America who seem to believe this stuff.
Yeah, but sure.
Part of the problem...
But his parents fled, right? I mean, they left.
Exactly. his parents left that. But it's I think what we've just done a really bad job of educating people, right? What was socialism? Why did it fail? Why were people miserable? Why was everybody fleeing from East Germany to West Germany instead of the other way around?
Yeah.
Even today, why do people flee North Korea and go to South Korea? And how come nobody wants to go from South Korea to North Korea? I mean, they're very basic.
And can questions. I interject?
Yeah.
Some of the people, some of the new voters in the Trump coalition are Hispanics who've come from countries in Latin America that have been experimenting with socialism recently. So it's ironic that Trump has been so vicious and cruel to Venezuelans who are here, because that's a huge population of people who are actually more sympathetic to the GOP than to the Democrats, exactly because Venezuela has become a socialist country.
So it's fascinating, right? Now, the way it seems to break down is that there are some countries that have experienced socialism or communism, whose immigrants tend to be fiercely against it. The Cubans are a good example. The Vietnamese are another very good example. But the Indians are not. The Indians are disproportionately lean toward the Democratic Party. And from whatever polling I've seen, they voted in large numbers for Zoran Mamdani. It may be because he speaks pretty good Hindi. Got to give him that. So maybe that's why. But it seems to sort of break down differently with different immigrant groups.
Yeah, that's interesting.
And it's not necessary that, you know, you would imagine that anybody who comes to this country fleeing a failed economic experiment would be sensitive to that and would strive really hard to ensure that this country does not make the same mistakes that their homeland made. Unfortunately, that is not the case very often.
Yeah. I mean, the reason I raised the colonialism thing is that I do think there are significant numbers of people, and I don't know if this also includes the Indian immigrants who are in the U.S. as well, but there are significant numbers of people who haven't grappled with the failure of socialism in India because of that looming image of colonialism, where they can always blame colonialism for whatever is wrong in India.
No, I think that's certainly part of it. I think, another part of it is that, and I've talked to many people about this, is that they somehow don't blame the ideas themselves, but they're like, well, it didn't work in India, but you know, over here, everything really works. So maybe we can make socialism work too.
Yeah. It just hasn't really been tried, as the old saying goes.
Exactly.
Right. Okay. But I want to dig a little deeper, because you're right. People don't really know, why these things aren't successful. It sounds good. You know, look, there's a problem with affordable food in Manhattan. Food's very expensive, not just Manhattan, the five boroughs. Well, why not set up grocery stores run by the state that won't have to pay taxes and therefore and won't have to pay rent because the city will give them the land? And then they'll provide fresh, you know, kale and avocados and wonderful things in communities for lower prices than they can currently get with the exploitative market system.
Right. First of all, these people have sort of no idea of the sort of really slim margins that your average grocery store is working with. Right. So how about some kind of what happens to that small business that you're trying to put out of business by standing up this state-owned option? That's the first part. And then secondly, they don't seem to be aware that governments just aren't very good at running businesses. It's not what they do well. It should be self-evident, right? And we've seen this. We've seen this movie in the Soviet Union. What you basically are going to end up with shelves with nothing on it, or you're going to, or the quality is going to be poor, or they're going to be overpriced. And it just seems like there's so many real problems to fix. And why would you go about trying these things that have been tried repeatedly in many parts of the world and have always failed?
Well, let's talk about rent control. Was rent control, it was. Tell us about rent control in India.
Oh, absolutely. And it's, again, the same kind of thinking, right? In India, basically, every after independence in 1947. Let me just rewind a little bit. So from around the end of the 19th century, this idea of blaming colonialism for everything really became in fashion. The theory that that was very popular was something called the drain theory. And the drain theory, as the name suggests, is that, you know, India used to be really rich and it had all this gold and it was this thriving country. And then the English showed up and they looted the country and they took all the wealth away. And that's why India is poor. Now, it's not as though there's no truth to that. It's not as though, you know, the colonialists weren't rapacious and so on. But the real story is actually it's just much more complicated, right? And the bottom line is that India, when you know people talk about how India was 25% of world GDP in the 1600s, but that's because the world had not industrialized. So once you have seen the industrial revolution, you have the West becoming much, much wealthier and countries like India falling behind. So when India became independent, the dominant thinking across the political class was that these leftist ideas were going to work. India's first prime minister, Jawaharlal Nehru, had visited the Soviet Union in the late 1920s, and he was taken for this kind of, you know, Potemkin village kind of tour. Mm-hmm. But it worked. And he came back and he gushed about the Soviet Union. And the idea was that, look, they can, what you have to do is develop faster. And for you to do that, you're going to need 5-year plans. You're going to need a state-led economy and so on. And this was, in fact, quite fashionable in the West, too. So mm-hmm. I'm working on a book right now. And, you know, if you go back to the 1960s, there are all these, you know, worthies of the Democratic Party who are applauding India's experiment with planning. Mm-hmm. And they're just a handful of lonely voices like Milton Friedman, who visited in 1955 and 1962 and said, guys, why are you spending millions of dollars trying to set up a 5-star hotel, state-owned 5-star hotel in New Delhi? You should be spending that money to train your people, because what matters in the end is the quality of your human capital. And the examples right. that Milton Friedman gave was like, look at Germany and look at Japan. They were destroyed, but they stood up so quickly after the war, albeit with U.S. help. In any case, the handful of people who were doubters, they didn't get much of an audience. India persisted with these policies for a long time. And it was only in 1991, where essentially by which time the government was essentially bankrupt, that it began to change course. And things, of course, have been...
It'd have to get bailed out by the IMF.
Yes. So it basically had... The Gulf War happened. India's a big energy importer. They ran out of foreign exchange. The IMF had to step in. In fact, India had to pawn a chunk of its gold reserves and send them on planes to the Bank of England. And so then they started sort of getting rid of things like industrial licensing and started opening up the economy. It's still not as open as it should be, but they started opening it up, you know, quite dramatically compared to what it was, bringing down customs rates, basically becoming more capitalist and less socialist. And since then, India has had the best 35 years of its history, because the economy has grown much faster. Obviously, it's still a very poor country, but it is far, far less poor. To just give you one quick statistic, you know, in 1977, about half of India's population living under the poverty line would have been classified as in extreme poverty. Today, the
less than a dollar a day, right? That's the
right.
definition.
And then that keeps changing. Right. It used to be a dollar a day. Then I think it became $2.10. But whatever the benchmark was for mm-hmm. Extreme poverty, and today that's probably less than 5%. Some economists say that's
amazing.
Disappeared. And that's because amazing. India embraced limited free market reforms. I've been arguing for a long time in the pages of the journal that they should have gone farther, faster. But even mm-hmm. with the limited reforms they've done, they have made a massive dent in they've almost eliminated extreme poverty, and they've made a massive dent in poverty. And so that's the story. But what happens with, you know, immigrants who come here? I think a lot of them come from relatively privileged backgrounds. And so I think, you know, they haven't really seen the worst of the deprivation. And then I also think that there's just a, you know, a natural tendency to sort of sometimes look at things, you know, through rose-tinted glasses, rather than, you know, looking at it more realistically and recognizing that outside of the communist world, this was one of the most controlled economies. And it's because of that, you or your father or whoever showed up with $10 in his pocket and made it. Why was he here with $10 in his pocket in the first place? And why was it not $10,000? And there's a reason for that.
So I too am a rabid believer in capitalism, and many people don't understand why they think that you must, you know, be a fan of Elon Musk or the wretched excess of billionaires and so forth. Nothing to do with that. It has to do with the very poorest people on the planet, who, in the cases of India and China, in our lifetimes, we have seen so many children not starve, so many women, you know, not be sold into sexual slavery, because these are things that happen in extreme poverty. We've liberated so many, limited capitalism, even small amounts of free markets have allowed people to escape the abject misery of extreme poverty. And that is the reason to cheer, to give, you know, three cheers for capitalism. Obviously, capitalism has its flaws too. Nothing in human life is ever perfect. And there are always problems and you have to address those. But I mean, just to miss that story about, you know, liberating tens of millions of people from poverty in the 20th century, is, you know, I think to miss one of the most important stories that we've ever seen.
Why do you think they miss it? I mean, is it just, my theory is just not taught, or is there something else going on?
I guess it isn't taught. I'm a believer also in teaching economics to high school students. I think that would help a lot, just to, you know, give the basics so that I think we should teach them economics. We should teach them a little, you know, more history. We should also teach them a little bit about like how to manage their money as they get into adulthood so that they won't be so vulnerable to scams and, frauds. But I'm not, I mean, I also think that it's because, even though there was a general, abandonment upon the part of intellectuals after the end of the Cold War, there was a stepping back from the idea that, well, the two systems each have their strengths and, you know, we can't really say which one is better. I mean, some are better for some countries and some are better for others. This was the kind of talk that you routinely heard, in the academy and in the educated classes before the Berlin Wall fell. And that has changed very much, but it hasn't changed so much that they are willing to then say, you know, come out and say, actually, not only is there no doubt which system is better, but we should actually be appreciating and singing the praises of what capitalism does for the poorest of the poor.
Oh, absolutely.
Yeah. All right. Now, there are other aspects, though, and these things do tend to go together, because, you know, the far left has, I think, their ideas about government grocery stores and rent control and defund the police, all of which Mamdani has endorsed. But they also go hand in hand with views about international issues. So why don't you talk a little bit about that and his kind of third world prejudices?
Well, you know, I was just struck by his comments on Israel, in particular, you know, when people were asking him a few weeks ago, quite persistently about why he would not condemn the slogan "globalize the Intifada," and he really, you know, he stood his ground on that, and he refused to. He's since budged a little bit, not that much, but at that point, he wasn't budging even an inch on that. And you know, this really again reminded me of the kind of people I grew up with, and it reminded me of this. There's of a lot of public intellectuals in places like, for example, Pakistan, that are just so one-dimensional when it comes to the question of Israel. And you know, one of the things that my last column on him sort of pointed to is that I think particularly on the right, we don't know how to sort of, we haven't understood or gauged him properly. And so you have people saying, you know, all kinds of things that are just frankly insane, right? Like Benny Johnson called him, I think he called him an Islamic jihadist or something like that. And Marjorie Taylor Greene, she tweeted this photo of the Statue of Liberty in a burqa. Laura Loomer came up with this bizarre conspiracy theory where she said that, you know, he chose to become a citizen on the same date some, you know, communique put out by Hezbollah in 1985. And so the way these people talk about him is just, you naturally, you can understand why anybody who is just a regular person is going to recoil from this stuff. Yeah. Because it, you know, it reeks of bigotry.
Mm-hmm.
But what that does is it lets him off the hook. And he should not be let off the hook, because you can reject the bigotry and you can still say that, look, there are positions that this person holds and there are statements that this person has made that are cause for concern. And so the argument that I made in my last column is that he is not an Islamist. This is not a guy who's going to, you know, he's not planning to shut down the bars in New York City. He's not going to ban music in the subway. That is not this guy.
He's not going to make the women of Manhattan wear burqas.
Right. His own wife doesn't wear one. And this guy is he's a Shiite. He's from a very commercial background. He's a Gujarati Shiite from East Africa. This is the, you know, very mobile, entrepreneurial, business oriented community that has.
Oh, see, I didn't know that. So the only thing I know about the Shiites is that they run Iran. So that's interesting. In Africa, yeah, they're
So over here, you think of Iran, you think of, okay, you think Khomeini when you think of Shia.
Yeah.
Right. But there are these small Shia communities from the western coast of India, which is where his family is from. And they are converts from Hinduism, but they're converts from trading castes in Hinduism. And so they have a very, so that they're business oriented. And many of these people are the, you know, people who were expelled from Uganda by Idi Amin, and including his own family. But in any case, in no way, shape or form is this guy going to be welcomed by ISIS. Right. So it's, yeah, just, I mean, it's,
so
it's
put that it's, to one side. Right.
It's ridiculous, right?
Right.
So put that to one side. However, if you sort of look at his positions, what they represent to me is the fact that the left, and particularly the far left, has made a lot of room for people who have extremely strident views on Israel. And that's the phenomenon that he represents. This is not an Islamist, but he is able to hold these extremely hardline views, extreme views, in my view, of Israel. And there's no pushback. Whereas I think someone who held the equivalent views, right, coming out of another religious tradition, and they were sort of, let's just say, you know, someone who was a Hindu nationalist, or someone who was, you know, strongly pro-settler, pro-settlement Zionist, or someone like, would be naturally shunned by these very same groups. But somehow when it comes to Islam and Muslims, there seems to be this tacit alliance. And so he represents that tacit alliance. He does not represent Islamism himself. And we and people who make that argument, they hurt themselves, because they allow him to pivot quite seamlessly to, you know, to something the media here loves to talk about, which is, you know, Islamophobia. And so he can just so we should diagnose the problem accurately, and we should speak about it soberly. And we should stop saying crazy things. But at the same time, we shouldn't avert our eyes from, you know, for example, globalize the Intifada, right? What was it? What was his response? His response was, I don't want to police speech. Okay. Mm-hmm. But nobody's telling you to ban it.
Yeah.
Nobody's telling you to arrest
people. Asking whether you endorse it.
Correct. Do you have a problem with it is what we're asking.
Yeah.
We're not telling, right? And yeah. And so people don't push him on that. And the other thing he was asked about was whether he would, whether he would recognize Israel as a Jewish state. And again, he had this, glib answer where he said that he wasn't, he couldn't.
Here, I have it right here. I wrote it down. He said, "I'm not comfortable supporting any state that has a hierarchy of citizenship on the basis of religion or anything else."
And right. You and said, so then my question is, okay, in that case, what were you doing celebrating Pakistan Day just the other day? Right. And it's a pretty fair question.
Yeah. By the way, Pakistan came into existence right around the same time that Israel did. Completely artificial.
And Pakistan was responsible for one of the few or the one of the best documented genocides in the 20th century during the creation of Bangladesh, when they sort of slaughtered hundreds of thousands of Bengalis, both Muslim and Hindu. And so this stuff just doesn't bear scrutiny. And I wish people would turn around and ask him that, but he never seems to get a follow up. Or let's talk about gay rights. How he's in Uganda right now, apparently. Where is Uganda on gay rights? How come that doesn't deserve any attention?
Right? Yeah.
So he has this kind of. Sorry, go ahead.
What do you think? Well, you have a quote in your piece from Michael Walzer who made that same point. You know, I'll just read it. "Most leftists have no difficulty fearing and opposing Hindu nationalists, zealous Buddhist monks, and the messianic Zionists of the settler movement. Yet the left will not blame religious extremism for Islamist militants who kidnap schoolgirls or murder heretics or tear down the ancient monuments of rival civilizations." What do you think accounts for that blind spot? And you say it's a tacit alliance between the far left and Muslim extremists. How do you account for that?
I mean, I think some of it is just a question of practicality. Like we saw, during the protests around the Iraq War more than 20 years ago, right? A lot of the ideas were coming from the leftist groups, but a lot of the street power was really coming from Muslim immigrants in places like London and Paris. So that's certainly part of it. I think part of it is ideological. I think that people regard, and with good reason, because Muslims are attacked often in extremely harsh and unfair ways.
As we were just mentioning.
Right, exactly. And so Muslims are regarded as a victim group which many other, and because they're regarded as a victim group, I think that some of the more extreme elements or extreme views tend to get a free pass because of that. I think that's another part of it. There's a very interesting essay I read the other day by Isabella Tavorowski, about how the Soviet Union, in fact, helped seed some of these things back starting in the 1960s, and then with the demise of apartheid in South Africa, a lot of these kind of this idea that this informal alliance between these revolutionary groups and Muslim groups kind of shifted its attention solely to Israel. So I think some of that is that's also there. So it's all these things together. And I think what people sometimes miss, and this is, this is a joke I often crack with my Pakistani friends, which is that, you could get two people who disagree on literally everything. They may disagree on hemlines and alcohol and music, even relations with India. But the one thing that they will all agree on is that Israel is the worst country in the world. And this is, it's a strain of, it's a kind of obsession, right? Mm-hmm. And that often comes, you often see in some of the most unsuccessful countries in the world, where they're not engaged with the very pressing problems in their own backyard, but they're obsessed with what's happening in Gaza on a sort of day-to-day basis. And to me,
which is not to say that there's no reason to be concerned about what's happening in Gaza. I mean, there are legitimate
reasons. It's also not to say that everybody who is concerned about Gaza is some bad person. Of course not. No. I think there are a lot of, you know, good, decent people who just, you know, are, you know, concerned by human suffering. And I'm not, but there is a kind of blindness. And a special, you know, a blindness to problems that are closer to home. So, for example, in Mamdani's case, you know, how could he be, you know, blind enough to walk into a Pakistan Day celebration while sounding so pious about why he won't recognize Israel as a Jewish state? So that's the blindness part. And it's just, and this obsession with Israel that as though nothing ever happens anywhere else that we should condemn.
And by the way, I think we didn't say, and so we should, just to clear up any potential confusion. We're not just saying that Mamdani is, you know, pro-Palestinian or is hostile to Israel. He has explicitly endorsed and praised Hamas. He has praised Holy Land Five. This, of course, many years ago.
He wrote a song about them, right?
He wrote a song about them. I mean, those are terrorists, and he's applauding anti-Israel terrorism. So that's not just expressing concern for the suffering of Palestinians. That's outright endorsement of terror.
And he has, in interviews, he has talked about how, you know, when he walked, you know, when he started associating with, first of all, this is a guy who comes to the Democratic Socialist or the socialist movement from a background as an organizer on Palestinian issues. He doesn't come to it with the economic agenda. That's where he starts. And he's been very open about it. He's talked about this. And then he shows up and he's been very frank about this in some interviews where he says that, well, I was just surprised that there are no taboos. You can go as far as you like on Israel. And you sure can. And we're seeing that before our eyes. And that's the phenomenon, because I feel that if he wins, and obviously he has a very good chance of winning, it really gives these ideas. I mean, there's always been room to criticize Israel, as there should be room to criticize, you know, any country or the policies of any government. But I don't think that in American public life, we have seen the same quality, that same shrillness in the debate about Israel that is very common, unfortunately, in the third world. And that's the tenor and the tone that he brings to this conversation. And I think that's very unfortunate.
Yeah, yeah. Not he alone, but yes. So tell us then, just shifting to India itself and its current leadership, what are your views about Modi's party and about Modi himself, about Hindu nationalism vis-a-vis Pakistani extremism? How do you feel about all of those things?
Well, I'm not a big fan of Hindu nationalism. And, you know, I come to this sort of, I wish that India had a political space for a party that was right of center on economics, basically a pro-market party that was welcoming to Indians of all faiths. There was such a party that existed in the 1960s and 70s. It does not exist right now. So I've been very critical of Modi on, you know, and the BJP on various issues. So, for example, their obsession with banning beef, which they do sort of, you know, for religious reasons. And I understand the religious sentiment. It's not as though I'm sort of contemptuous of the religious sentiment, but these are not the kinds of things that I support, and these are the kinds of things that I have criticized. But the issue really in the subcontinent or in India in particular is that what you had was a traditional left of center ruling elite. And that left of center ruling elite was very well intentioned, but they did not take seriously the genuine problem that people had with illiberal elements in India's very large Muslim minority. And so basically you have two bad choices in my view. You have a group of leftists who refuse to acknowledge that there is such a thing as Islamism. There is such a thing as Islamic extremism. albeit this is something that affects a small percentage of Muslims, and it's utterly wrong to, you know, portray all Muslims as Islamists or extremists. So that's the problem on the left. But the problem on the Hindu right is that they paint, it's the same problem that we have with the MAGA right over here, is that they paint all Muslims with the same brush. They don't distinguish between an ordinary Muslim who's just going about his or her day, just living their lives, running a business, going to work or whatever, and somebody who is in fact espousing hardline Islamic views, calling for Sharia law or whatever. And this is, I think, you know, in many ways a problem of our time, not just in India. Yeah. So I think in India, you know, we have, you know, it's a situation where the politics presents no really good choices, in my view. And so when Mamdani criticizes the BJP and Modi, I think some of his criticisms are completely valid. Some of his criticisms are completely fair. But I find him somewhat one-dimensional, because he doesn't sort of understand that there's more to it, and there's another side of the story where there's stuff to criticize on the other side too.
Okay. I realize that I'm doing a very quick potted history of an entire subcontinent, and I apologize to my viewers who are very well versed in all of this, but I think for many people, a lot of this is not well understood. So I want to just touch on a couple more things. And one of them is, you've written about Bangladesh's successful export-driven economy. And I would like you to talk just for a minute about, so after partition, India was divided, what had been the subcontinent under the British Raj, divided into a Muslim country, Pakistan, Hindu country, India. Obviously, there are some populations in between. There are Sikhs also who... but then later, Pakistan split into East and West and followed very different paths. So can you talk a little bit about what happened with Pakistan?
Yeah, so first to rewind. So basically, you had two movements that became very prominent in the last two decades of British rule from the 1920s, and then the second one started in 1930. One was the struggle for Indian independence, which was led by Gandhi and Nehru. And what these people were determinedly non-sectarian. They were people who were Hindu, but there were plenty of senior Muslims in the Congress Party. In fact, the president of the Congress Party between 1939 and 1946 was a Muslim who became a minister in Nehru's first cabinet. On the other side of it, you did have a party called the Muslim League, which basically said that Muslims and Hindus cannot live together, and they wanted a separate homeland created out of Muslim majority areas. That was the sort of the quest for the creation of Pakistan, and they succeeded. So India, when it was created in when it became independent in 1947, it did have a Hindu majority, but it was not a Hindu country. It was a secular country, which was about at that point roughly about 85% Hindu, and then the rest was Muslims and Christians. With the largest chunk were Sikhs and so on, but the largest chunk were Muslims. What happened with Pakistan was that it was two parts. One was what is Pakistan today, which was basically Punjab, Sindh, the Northwest Frontier province, and Balochistan. And then you had the province of Bengal on the east, half of which went to India and became the Indian state of West Bengal, which is the part where the Hindus were in a majority. And the other half became East Pakistan in those days, in 1947, because it was a Muslim majority part of Bengal. There was an awful civil war in 1971. We talked about it earlier, and there were these massacres, one of the best documented genocides of the 20th century. And that was when...
Which Harrison wrote a song about it.
Exactly. And that's when Bangladesh became an independent country. Now, when Bangladesh was born, everybody thought it had no future. Henry Kissinger was supposed to have referred to it as a basket case. And, you know, so this is a country, this is your prototypical a third world basket case. People are really poor. They don't have enough clothes. They don't have enough food.
They don't have natural resources.
A hurricane would hit every few months. And, you know, there'd be like all these horrific stories of people being killed, natural disasters. Yeah. That was Bangladesh. And it was the poorer part of Pakistan, comparatively, because the part that became what remained in Pakistan was a part where the Brits had built a lot of irrigation canals and so on in Punjab. So those people were in general more prosperous than was East Pakistan and became Bangladesh. But Bangladesh has been a success story over the last several decades, in part because it embraced labor-intensive manufacturing and it became a garment superpower. If some of your listeners and viewers, I mean, they could sort of, if they turn to their shirts, they might find a made in Bangladesh label. It's fairly common now.
It is.
And it's still a poor country. They're going through some turmoil because they have a government that came into power about a year ago, which I think is sort of struggling to run the country. So I don't think Bangladesh is out of the woods. I don't think Bangladesh is a success story in the way that, you know, Vietnam is a success story, or in the way that South Korea or
Singapore
or Singapore. It's not one. It's still a poor country with very serious problems, but it's a country which everybody had written off, and the fact that they are still around, that they have made very big strides in removing poverty, that they've become a garment exporting power, is a good news story. And so I just wanted to, point that out, because, you know, most people don't really write about Bangladesh in the West.
That is so true. Though we do see it on our clothing labels. And just a word, if you can, about the situation in Pakistan. I mean, how are they doing? I mean, I know they are, you know, kind of on a regular basis, sending terrorists over the border into India, which is a huge problem. And sometimes we get close to war again between the two countries. But in other ways, how is Pakistan doing? Is it a struggling country? Is it prospering? How's it doing?
It's not doing, unfortunately, it's not doing well at all. And part of the problem is that, you know, in both Bangladesh and Pakistan, right? I mean, there was this sort of, the genesis was this idea of creating a Muslim homeland. They weren't all extremists, but there were extremist elements who were given space in both of those countries. But in Bangladesh, just to draw the contrast, you had two competing ideas of nationalism. You had Muslim nationalism, which was, let's create a country because we are Muslims and we're not Hindus, so we can't live with the Hindus. But there was also Bengali nationalism, which led to the creation of Bangladesh in 1971, which was that, well, we have our own language. And what the Pakistanis were trying to do was to suppress the Bengali language. And that's why these people revolted. And they said, you can't suppress our language. We have our own language. And because Bangladesh had these two options, it's done a better job than Pakistan on pushing back against people who said that the only way to hold a country together is through religion. And the religion in this case would be Islam. Pakistan did not have that option. Right? So it defined itself from its birth as the un-India. And one of the things that was very unfortunate for Pakistan is that it inherited a large proportion, not the majority, but proportionally a large part of the British Indian Army. And so from the start, the most powerful institution in Pakistan was the army. It has ruled the country directly for about half the country's history and indirectly for most of the rest. Like, for example, recently the chief of the army, a guy called Field Marshal Asim Munir, was in Washington, and he had lunch with Trump along with his spy chief. And this is kind of, you know, it would be preposterous, right? In most, no other country, or hardly any other country, I can't think of any other country where there is technically an elected serving prime minister, but the person who meets with President Trump is the army chief.
Right.
And it's because the army holds all the cards. They are the most powerful institution. They've done a very bad job with the economy. And part of the reason was that very early on, Pakistan became addicted to aid from the U.S. And they found a way to always make themselves useful to the U.S. when the U.S. needed them. So, for example, in the 1950s, they joined all these alliances, CENTO and CETO. Then in the 1980s, they were the frontline state when the U.S. was fighting the Soviet Union in Afghanistan. A lot of the, you know, the arms were basically being funneled through Pakistan. And then when the war on terror started, this was complicated because the Pakistanis were helping the terrorists, but also helping us against the terrorists. So they were kind of playing both sides. They were on both sides of the ledger. But all of this means that the elites in Pakistan figured out that the best way to get rich and the best way to have a good lifestyle was to basically figure out a way to jump on the U.S. aid.
Gravy train.
And they, unlike Bangladesh, which actually tried to do some work, you know, tried to build a garment industry and so on, the Pakistani government has not focused on the economy. Their growth rates are very low. They're in the midst of an IMF program. At this point, I've lost track of how many IMF programs they've been through. And they have a very rapidly growing population. So a combination of sluggish economic growth, growing population, and the fact that by no means is the entire population fundamentalist or even a majority, but there, let's just say that there's a lot of room for some pretty blood-curdling fundamentalism, right? So, for example, they have blasphemy laws, they have regular lynchings of anybody. You know, if someone is, you and I are just having a conversation and I kind of turn around and I say that, you know, well, Mona said something about the Prophet Muhammad. Before you know it, there'd be, you know, 100 people at your door trying to break it down to, you know. And so it's pretty gory. The minority, the situation with religious minorities is quite bleak. So which is why I kind of, you know, bringing it back to Mamdani, I kind of find it funny that he goes to a Pakistan Day celebration, doesn't say a word. He's been interviewed on Pakistani TV. And it's just, it's just fine. But then when it comes to Israel, it's sort of this, oh, well, you know, I really can't because they privilege Jewish, this Jewish faith over other faiths. Well, you know, I'm a man of principle. I'm a secularist. Well, I'm new. So the long and the short of it is that Pakistan is not doing well. And we don't pay much attention to it in Washington anymore because we're not in Afghanistan anymore. So I remember,
we don't need them. So we ignore them.
Yeah. You know, so, you know, about 15 years ago, you had mainstream journalists in Washington who could kind of tell you about different factions of the Haqqani network.
Yes, and, you know, absolutely.
There was real Pakistan expertise in this town.
Yeah.
And now, you know, I write about Pakistan from time to time because I'm interested in it. And I may write, maybe two or three columns a year on Pakistan. And those are the only two or three columns in the year that you would see in any of the major newspapers in the U.S.
Yeah, which is why I'm glad we got a chance to talk about it now. Let me ask you also, though, about India and the Hindu nationalism there. What is the state of democracy in India? Is it robust, or is Hindu nationalism itself a threat?
So it just depends on how you define democracy, right? There is nothing I talk about that gets more feedback on Twitter or X, whatever, you know, what it's called these days, than when I write an article critical of Indian democracy. And so I've been spending a lot of time thinking about that. And here's the conclusion. If you think of democracy as electoral democracy, do people go out and vote and choose their government? India's democracy is thriving. The last three elections in India have had the highest three turnouts in the history of India. And every time India has an election, it is by definition the largest franchise in human history, because you have more than 1.4 billion people in the country. So on those measures, on that measure specifically, Indian democracy is thriving. Where it is having problems is on the liberal part of liberal democracy. And just, you know, not everyone follows this so closely. By that, I don't mean that there are no liberal politicians. It just means that the institutions that have been set up to check power, right? The media, the judiciary, the independent civil service, this is all very familiar to Bulwark listeners, not because of India, but because, right, because of here. those have really, you know, those institutions have proven to be quite weak. Mm-hmm. Now, you could argue, and I have argued, that to a large extent, this is just simply a function of having a strong executive. Modi is very popular. This is his third term in office. If you go back and look at Indian history over the last 75 years, you know, some of your listeners may remember Indira Gandhi. You know, whenever you've had a powerful executive, the media and the judiciary have tended to be cowed. However, there's an extra kind of wrinkle that Hindu nationalism adds to it, which is that Hindu nationalism has a fundamentally adversarial relationship with non-Hindus, specifically with Muslims and Christians. And in particular, because of a particular view of history that they hold with Muslims. So I would argue that any party in power in India, if anyone had enjoyed the kind of majorities that Modi enjoyed for the first 10 years, that government would probably have done what it could to bully the media and to bully the courts. But with the Hindu nationalists, you have that added wrinkle of sectarian or religious animus toward non-Hindus. And that to me makes it, adds one additional layer of stress on Indian democracy. The flip side of it, and again, you know, the comparisons that are made often are with places like Hungary or with Turkey. But the one big difference, which I think is that India is just so enormous that it's really hard to be truly repressive just because it's so enormous and so inefficient. So for example, let's just say you live in Kolkata, which used to be Calcutta. You could spend all day writing op-eds criticizing Modi and nothing's going to happen to you. But if you say anything against the local leader, the equivalent of governor, the chief minister, you're going to be in trouble really fast. Huh. So it's not great, but because India is so big and you have lots of petty despots in different places, as an entity, it kind of still gives you more room than you would have in, say, a place like Turkey or a place like Hungary, which is much more centralized. So this is not to say this is not to minimize the problems, but just to point out that it makes India in some ways a unique case.
And is this different from the way things were pre-Modi, yes, 15 years ago?
Absolutely. But that's because pre-Modi, you had the governments between 1989 and 2014, India did not have a single government with a single party majority in parliament.
Okay.
So these were coalition governments. There were a lot of small parties. Some of the small parties were very dependent on the Muslim vote. And so they kind of like, you know, they didn't have the Hindu nationalist ideology, first of all, but they were also much weaker and they were coalition governments. The other thing that's happened with populism in India, which is, you know, common to populisms around the world, is that it's an anti-elitist phenomenon. And the elitists in India were the people, you know, the English-speaking classes, the people who were, you know, more likely to have been educated or exposed to the United States or to the United Kingdom, people who, you know, just had more familiarity with the idea that, you know, the job of a journalist is to be mean to the prime minister, not to praise him. So all of these things together, right? The fact that this is an anti-elite phenomenon, and so these have all come together, you know, to put a lot of stress on the liberal part.
Right.
Of Indian liberal democracy.
Right. So interesting. Thank you very much, Sadanand.
Thank you for having me. It was such a pleasure to talk with you.
Yeah, you've enlightened us on some really important matters. So I appreciate it very much and hope you'll come back.
Thank you.